From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Richard Cohen. 30 years ago, when he was a 25-year-old television news producer, he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. For a while, he kept his condition secret and took assignments in the war zones of Lebanon and El Salvador. He's written a memoir about his psychological battle with illness. Also, what previously secret documents reveal about Operation Condor, six Latin American dictatorships which formed an alliance in the 70s to track down their enemies and assassinate them. These military leaders looked to the U.S. for technical assistance and strategic leadership. Journalist John Dingus has written a new book about the Condor years and its lessons for today's war on terrorism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal officials in Seattle say a National Guardsman has been charged with trying to provide information to terrorists. The Guardsman, identified as Specialist Ryan G. Anderson, has been charged with aiding the enemy by wrongfully attempting to communicate and give intelligence to the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. Anderson is being held at Fort Lewis, an army base near Tacoma, Washington. He's a member of the National Guard's 81st Armored Brigade, which is currently preparing to deploy to Iraq. The most senior commander in the U.S. Army in Iraq has escaped an attack by insurgents in the town of Fallujah. And the BBC's Simon Wilson has details.
According to a military spokesman, the convoy carrying General Abizaid had just arrived at an Iraqi military base in the town of Fallujah when there was a series of explosions. U.S. soldiers returned fire, and there was a brief gun battle with unidentified gunmen sheltering in a building nearby. There were no injuries to anyone in the convoy, which continued into the base. This is at least the third time a senior American figure has come under attack in Iraq over the past year. Previous incidents have involved a convoy carrying the U.S. administrator here, Paul Bremer, and a rocket attack on a hotel housing the Deputy Defense Secretary, Paul Wolfowitz. In each case, there's been no indication that the high-profile Americans had been specifically targeted.
The BBC's Simon Wilson. Democratic Party officials say retired General Wesley Clark will endorse Senator John Kerry in his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. Clark dropped out of the race this week after finishing in third place in primaries in Virginia and Tennessee. Party officials say Clark is expected to declare his support for Kerry at a campaign stop in Wisconsin tomorrow. The federal government has indicted four people for allegedly providing performance-enhancing drugs to baseball, football, and track stars. No athletes were charged or named in the indictment, which was returned by a grand jury in San Francisco. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The 42-count indictment names one of the world's top track coaches, the personal trainer for baseball player Barry Bonds, and two executives of the Bay Area Lab Cooperative, or BALCO. Attorney General John Ashcroft says the defendants sold substances that were designed to pass drug tests.
The defendants are alleged to have conspired to distribute illegal performance-enhancing drugs, including anabolic steroids, human growth hormone, and various other prescription drugs to dozens of athletes.
The indictment says the four defendants allegedly hid their activities by using false names on mailing labels and referring to the drugs by code. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 43 points to close at 10,694 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 16 points, or 0.75%, to close at 2073. This is NPR News. City officials in San Francisco are granting marriage licenses to gay couples in defiance of California law. Officials at City Hall have conducted marriage ceremonies for at least eight same-sex couples. The action challenges a state law that defines marriage as a union between one man and one woman. The Bush administration's plans for space exploration met with skepticism on Capitol Hill today. Some in Congress aren't happy with the plans for funding human trips to the moon and Mars. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The White House simply won't say how much it will cost to send humans back to the moon or on to Mars, and that's proving to be a source of frustration on Capitol Hill. The House Science Committee wants a total number so it can decide whether the missions are worth the cost. At a hearing, some members expressed concern that bold new human plans could come at the expense of science missions, such as robotic trips to other planets and Earth observation programs. Bush administration officials say they don't have a total number in mind. Instead, they plan to increase the NASA budget modestly, shift funding within the agency, and let the plans and technology develop at whatever pace that would permit. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
The hit-and-run case against Roman Catholic Bishop Thomas O'Brien has gone to a jury in Phoenix, Arizona. O'Brien is accused of leaving the scene after hitting a pedestrian with his car. The man died from his injuries. The bishop, who resigned as head of the Phoenix diocese last year, said he believed he had hit a dog or a rock and was afraid to get out of his car. If he's convicted, O'Brien could face as much as 3 years and 9 months in prison. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, embracing the diversity of more than 100,000 employees across America and the people they serve. SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Richard Cohn is a former senior producer for CBS News and CNN and has covered all kinds of stories, including war. But in his new book, Blindsided, he reports on himself and his own psychological battle with illness. 30 years ago, when he was 25, he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. At the time, he was an up-and-coming producer for ABC and was also finishing a documentary for the PBS news show, The McNeil-Lehrer Report. The documentary was about, ironically enough, the politics of disability. On top of MS, which has left him legally blind and with limbs that don't function well, Cohn has had a couple of bouts with colon cancer. Before writing his new memoir, he read his own story as told in the tabloids and the personality press, which were interested in his marriage to Meredith Vieira, one of the hosts of The View. Cohn says that it made him crazy to read headlines like "Secret Family Tragedy of TV Host Meredith Vieira" and "Beautiful TV Host Meredith Vieira Hides Heartbreaking Secret."
I looked at those magazines.
Yeah.
I looked at those tabloids. And given the culture that we're in, I guess it should be no surprise that in their own reductionist way, they had to make Meredith into a martyr and they had to make me into a victim. And for a long time, there was a zone of privacy because I really didn't talk about it. And even People magazine at one point did a fairly long profile of Meredith with photos and the kids and everything. And they never mentioned my health problems. And I thought, you know, this is pretty cool. And I think, so I was quite startled to see it in the Star and some of these other publications. And what bothered me the most is that as Meredith and I have struggled to maintain a normal life and to make sure our kids understand that these problems have to be put in perspective and that we can survive them as a family, you know, there are the magazines and the newspapers trumpeting the tragedy. And I think what started to push me over the edge, as long as it's just the tabloids, you know, you can shrug it off and look the other way. But some of the more mainstream publications, magazines, ladies, women's magazines in particular, such as Ladies Home Journal, really focused on the word tragedy and talked about Meredith's tears and really presented our lives in a way that was skewed toward the overly dramatic. And it bothered me because, A, it made me self-conscious, and, B, what kind of a lesson is that to the kids, or message is that to the kids? You know, I'm telling them, we're telling them one thing about our lives, and they see a very different version in popular culture. And I was very happy in this book to have my say, because it really was just getting, you know, pretty insufferable.
It's interesting that it was your father who first diagnosed the MS. You were describing your symptoms to him on the phone, that you were dropping things, that you were numb in some places. And your father is both a physician and he has MS, so he called you back and told you you had MS. And your father gave you the advice of, you know, don't tell anybody, or tell as few people as possible. And you said that his sense of discretion bordered on silence. Do you think he gave you good advice in trying to keep it fairly secret?
Well, I've sort of come full circle on that, and I give him more credit today than perhaps I did at the time. I really wanted to believe that there were generational differences between us and that what worked for him in his time really didn't necessarily apply to me in my time. Don't forget, he was a physician, and you remember the old Aesop's fable that ended, physician, heal thyself. And I think that his concern with his own life was that people were not going to trust him to take care of them because he was flawed physically. And that may be a sad reality, but there probably was some truth to it. So, the more things change, the less they change. And I think my father was probably quite astute in his advice about what you tell employers. And as I related in the book, Cronkite's old executive producer, longtime executive producer, Sandy Sokolow, who's a marvelous journalist, a man in his 70s, told me not all that long ago that he was really glad that I didn't tell him, that I hadn't told him at the beginning, because he just might not have hired me.
Journalist Richard Cohn is my guest, and he's written a new memoir, which is called Blindsided, and it's about how his life has been changed by living with MS. When you got the news, when you got the diagnosis that you had MS, which is a degenerative disease, so you knew it, and you knew this from your father too, that it was gonna get worse, not better. How did you handle the news? I mean, when you get news like that, do you have this like tape loop in your head that won't quit that says, "Oh my God, MS, MS, and it's gonna get worse. This is horrible. This is bad. I'm gonna be in pain. I'm not gonna be able to do things." Do you know what I mean? Do you have that kind of like obsessive tape loop that won't quit when you get news like that?
Well, I had what for me was a somewhat odd reaction. First of all, the news was not unexpected. Second of all, I had sort of prepared myself as much as you can for that kind of news. And I just sat back and I hung up the phone and I thought to myself, I don't know enough about MS to react. I mean, I'm not going to disintegrate. I'm not going to get upset about a condition I know so little about. And I really thought I had to put it on the shelf and was surprised by my ability to do so. And what that meant to me, and others would call that denial, but what that accomplished was buying me some time. Instead of getting thrown off my feet, it allowed me to learn what I had to learn about the disease over a period of time. And it really allowed me to maintain my emotional equilibrium, stay on my feet, and keep going in a career television news that I knew would be physically very demanding. And
So you kind of think denial isn't necessarily a bad thing, at least in the short term.
Well, I've taken a lot of grief from friends and family over the years about being in a state of denial. You know, it's one thing if you're standing on the tracks and a freight train is coming toward you and it's going rather quickly and it's a rather large train and you deny that the train's going to hit you, then I think arguably denial's not such a terrific idea. But I think that at different stages of your life with less certain outcomes, I think denial is a very useful weapon, really, against falling apart emotionally. And I do think that with a range of chronic illnesses, that denial is a very useful tool because it really allows you to slow down and take stock of things.
After you got your diagnosis of MS, you continued your work as a television journalist. And in fact, you ended up in a few war zones, including Beirut and, was it El Salvador?
Yes.
So here you are, diagnosed with MS, dodging bullets, diving under cars for cover. You write about this a little bit in your memoir, that it kind of helped distract you in a way from your illness to put your life in jeopardy like that. But can you explain a little bit more what it was like for you to know that you were becoming increasingly vulnerable and at the same time to expose yourself to the dangers of war reporting.
Well, I think it was counterphobic behavior, meaning that I think I took what I feared the most and I went and did it. I also was, I was really on a mission that in my mind grew reckless after some years. But I really, it was so important to me to prove to myself that I could do what the guy, the other guy was doing, you know, that I could get out there with men and women who were putting their lives on the line, who were covering wars in dangerous situations, and pull it off. I, you know, the more you can do those kinds of things, the more you can deny your problems. I, look, make no mistake about one thing. I believed mightily in the news business until I reached the point where I believed the news business was failing all of us, and then I got out. But I was deeply committed to the work, and it meant all the world to me to be able to do it as fully as I could do it.
So when you were working in war zones, what symptoms had already kicked in?
Well, again, this was 20 years ago, and I was already legally blind, which was the certainly the largest limiting factor that I had to deal with every day. And, you know, and when you go out to cover an incident, whether it's in Beirut or Salvador or any number of places, obviously, you've really got to have your wits about you. You've got to be able to see clearly. Well, seeing clearly just sort of took on a different meaning for me. You know, a lot of what saved me was that, unlike a newspaper reporter, perhaps, television is a collaborative medium. You rarely went out alone. You went out with a camera crew and perhaps a correspondent, and I could rely on other people to see what I couldn't see. I dare say that in many or most cases, they really didn't know what my limitations were. I mean, I don't think that my illness was a hot topic of conversation, you know, even at CBS News, which is interesting because I just think when people are sick, it just makes, you know, it's good fodder for the gossip mill, if nothing else. But I think that the people who knew really didn't say much to anybody else because I never got the sense from my colleagues in any of these places that they were concerned about me.
Well, you know, during this period that we're talking about, you weren't really out in journalism in terms of having MS. People didn't know about it. One of the first people you told in the business was Ted Koppel. How did it end up being him?
Well, Ted, I worked at ABC, and Ted was making a trip to China, I think his second trip after he had gone with Nixon on the initial trip that sort of opened up China to journalists. And Ted, very mindful that he was not going to get the free flow of information over there, set up a system with me where State Department people would call me, and I was 25 years old, and he was going to call me, and I was going to, in some clever way, disguise the information. It was, in retrospect, it was a little preposterous, I guess. But I was going to pass it on to him even before he had been there probably a week. I had a major relapse. I lost vision in one eye and ended up in the hospital. And so his calls to me were patched into Georgetown Hospital instead of up to my office. All of a sudden, he wants to know, what the heck's going on? You're in the hospital. It was a very hard moment because, I hadn't even told the ABC people I was in the hospital. I was so obsessively secret that suddenly, here's Ted Koppel. He's my friend, my colleague. What am I going to say to the guy? And when I said it, of course, he couldn't hear it, so I had to shout it. It was in just a very small way, was a watershed moment because I was, in effect, coming out of the closet. I was admitting to somebody I was sick, which was something that I wanted desperately to deny myself. And, you know, it was an interesting experience, but then I just kept my mouth shut again. And I don't think he told anybody, because I think he sensed that I had confided in him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the secret was safe for a while.
My guest is journalist Richard Cohen. His new memoir is called Blindsided. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Richard Cohen. His new memoir, Blindsided, is about his psychological war with illness. He was diagnosed with MS 30 years ago. When you did tell your colleagues in the news business that you had MS, did people start to treat you any differently, professionally or personally?
Well, I didn't really. I mean, the big moment was having faked my way through a company physical, having done a sleight of hand with the eye exam in particular, where I examined my better eye twice so they wouldn't have to see what was wrong with, you know, the more damaged eye. I squeaked past the physical, and I kept the whole situation a secret. I was terrified. I didn't know how it was. You know, I can't drive anymore. Producers are supposed to be people who jump out of airplanes without a parachute and, you know, and hit the ground before anybody else comes in, the camera crew, the correspondent, whatever. And suddenly, here I am in the big time working for Walter Cronkite, and I couldn't rent a car, drive anywhere. And it was a pretty daunting experience. And I didn't tell anybody for probably 6 months until I really had a sense that I was doing well and that I was secure there. You know, however it was done, they got what they wanted. And it was very comfortable because they never once sort of wondered, is it safe for him to go there? You know, is this responsible? I think their attitude was, if he's ready to go and, you know, the guy's got a track record, then we're going to send him.
You're married to Meredith Vieira. When you met, how long did it take you to tell her about your medical condition?
Well, it was done quickly for two reasons. It was really our second day. First of all, being legally blind, it doesn't take long for a person you're with in a social situation, just in the routine ways that it happens, to realize that something's the matter. You know, I mean, you say, you know, you see that person over there, or you're in a theater, and what did you think of the sets, or whatever, all the things that I couldn't possibly see. So that then the questions start. And the other thing is that I just learned over a period of time that people responded very differently. And some people headed for the fire exit, and some people didn't seem to be put off by it. And if you're out to dinner, why invest in dessert, you know, if you can save the money if they're going to run?
And she didn't run.
No, she didn't run. I mean, she was taken aback, as one would expect. And, you know, Meredith and I are both sarcastic people, I think. Humor is a very important part of our lives. And she was funny about it, but we did have serious conversations. But again, she was, don't forget, she was sitting across from somebody who didn't show real signs of physical distress that would come in the years to follow. And it's very hard, I think, for any individual to almost extrapolate, to look down the road and imagine worst case scenarios. You know, if you're sitting with somebody who really beyond my eyesight, doesn't show any signs of physical problems.
The worst-case scenario for you was in some ways worse than you expected, in the sense that you not only have MS, but you've had two bouts of colon cancer, which seems like, you know, like it's really not fair. Not that fairness enters into it, but it just, you know, doesn't seem fair.
Well, my mother said to me on the phone, you know, this isn't fair. And I said, you're right, it should have been my brother. And she didn't think, she didn't think that was very funny. But it, you know, when you're sick, you know, you can say this just isn't fair, but where do you go from there? You know, I always tell people that if you can tell me who to sue, I will happily get a lawyer. But, you know, that's just one of these things that just doesn't take you anywhere. And there's really no point in going very far. Even if you indulge yourself in a few minutes of that, it really doesn't take you anywhere, and you might as well just get off it and get on with your life.
Yeah, easier said than done. It's hard to stop thinking about stuff like that sometimes.
You know what? There's no denying that the cancer was devastating, especially the second time around. You know, I had a temporary ileostomy. I lost 30 pounds. It kicked in a lot of the MS. Just the stress on my body kicked in a lot of the MS problems. And I was really a wreck physically, and came home from the hospital with anger and really despair. And there was nothing instant about the process of coping and feeling whole again emotionally.
Where are you now health-wise?
Well, my health is pretty good again. You know, it's always as compared to what, but I'm cancer-free. I've got a lot of gut issues that just go with, you know, the surgeries that I had and make life difficult. And the MS is a band that just keeps playing on, you know. And, you know, I have more mobility problems. I have greater problems using my arms, and my voice is, as you can probably hear, very much affected by this. My eyesight is stable, but, you know, having said all of that, I have a pretty good life. I don't feel like Job at all. I mean, if you were a fly on the wall in our house, you would hear the laughing and the fighting and see people doing their homework. And everybody in the family has got a great sense of humor. And there are no martyrs in our house. There really aren't. There's neither time nor room for that sort of state of mind. And everybody's got a job to do, and we do it.
Richard Cohen's new memoir is called Blindsided. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, The Extraordinary World War II Story of the Navy's Finest Hour by James D. Hornfisher. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what recently released secret documents reveal about the U.S. connection to Operation Condor, six Latin American dictatorships which formed an alliance in the 70s to track down and assassinate their enemies. John Dingus, who covered the Pinochet regime in Chile, has written a new book about the Condor years and its lessons for today's war on terrorism. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Recently declassified secret documents reveal the U.S. connection to Operation Condor, the secret alliance between six Latin American military dictatorships in the 70s, which was formed to track down the regime's enemies and assassinate them. The six countries in Condor were Chile, Paraguay, Uruguay, Brazil, Bolivia, and Argentina. Journalist John Dingus covered the Pinochet regime in Chile and was briefly detained by Chile's secret police. Now he's written a new book called The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents. Dingus says the Condor story holds a cautionary lesson for today's war on terrorism. Dingus is a former managing editor of NPR News and has written for The Washington Post and Time. He teaches at Columbia University. He's also a senior fellow at the National Security Archive, which works to uncover America's recent secret history by filing to declassify documents through the Freedom of Information Act. Now, you say in your book that although Operation Condor may have begun as a way to stop the violent revolutionaries who were opposing the military dictatorships, it ended up being an attack on anybody who opposed the military dictatorships.
And I think that it started out that way as well. I interviewed one of the people who was present at the founding meeting of Operation Condor in November of 1975. It was clear from, he said, I have some documents from that meeting. They talk about intelligence exchange. They don't talk about this is a plan to assassinate people worldwide. But the eyewitness that I interviewed said that in the introduction, it was made clear that this was set up to track down their adversaries. And he used as an example people like Letelier, people like the former foreign minister of Chile who was killed in Washington. The idea always was to track down the military rivals of Pinochet and the other governments and the people who had credibility in Europe, in the United States, among democratic politicians. And those were the most prominent victims. The revolutionaries were less known, and they were the majority of the victims. Hundreds of them were tracked down and killed. Most of them were Uruguayans and Chileans and Paraguayans and Bolivians who were killed in Argentina.
How did you find out that Operation Condor existed, that six Latin American dictatorships were actually working together to track down and, in some cases, assassinate people who they saw as their enemies?
I first came across the existence of Operation Condor when I wrote a book in 1980 called Assassination on Embassy Row, which was the story of the Letelier assassination. A source, an FBI agent, who I now name in the book, he's since died, told me in great detail how a week after the assassination, he was told by an Argentine intelligence source that Condor existed, that it had three phases: intelligence exchange, joint operations in Latin America, and the stage three, which was assassinations in outside of Latin America, in the United States. And this source told the FBI agent that Letelier was a wild Condor operation. In other words, it was a Condor operation that was counterproductive, that was going to cause problems for what he considered to be a good operation. That episode, I didn't know any details of how it was organized. I just knew of its existence and was able to presume that certain assassinations had occurred because of Operation Condor.
Now, you could say that the United States wasn't fully aware of the extent of the atrocities perpetrated by the secret police in the six countries that were involved with Operation Condor, but you found memos that showed that they really did know the extent of the atrocities.
In addition to the general complicity in the crimes of these military dictatorships, I'm able to show exact knowledge by the CIA and the FBI of actual operations of Operation Condor. In some cases, there were reports of the from inside the prisons, briefings given to the CIA and to the FBI of the interrogations of people who were held and being tortured under Operation Condor. The information in one case is within 24 hours. I know the date of the arrest of these, in this case, 28 people, and the information report, the report of that arrest is 24 hours later in a Pentagon cable. The intimacy of the contact between the Operation Condor operatives and U.S. intelligence agency was really astounding. We're dealing in the 1970s with our friends. These are our allies. The people who are committing these acts of terrorism are America's allies, not our enemies. And so the intelligence comes from the very intimacy of our contacts with these people. They're telling us these what they are doing, assuming that we endorse what they are doing.
What kind of assistance or advice did the United States offer the Latin American dictatorships in Operation Condor?
I document a series of technical type assistance. The Operation Condor was created by Chile, and they brought in five other countries of the Southern Cone. They also invited other countries like Venezuela, who turned them down. And that was fortunate because I was able to interview people there who gave me great detail about the nature of the invitation to join Condor. Number one, the United States was a consultant, so to speak. Whenever Colonel Manuel Contreras, who was the chief of the secret police in Chile, whenever he was moving to the next step in the creation of his secret police and then in the creation of Condor, he would go to the United States for a meeting with the CIA. We don't know the nature of those meetings, but the timing is very coincidental. We know, according to him, that the CIA sent 8 trainers to Santiago in 1974, just prior to the first mission of Operation, actually Operation Condor didn't exist yet, but just prior to the first international assassination committed by Chile. Does that mean that the CIA agents trained them in assassinations? I don't know that, but definitely the intimacy of the contact was notable. There were computers provided to specifically to Operation Condor, according to one of my sources. There was an encoding machine that handled the telex transmission so that they could be transmitted in code. And there was a radio network for most of Latin America set up by the Pentagon, and that was also provided to the intelligence services for use in Operation Condor. The conclusion is that the United States encouraged this kind of intelligence collaboration, but perhaps, and this, of course, I don't know for a fact, but this would be the exculpatory version from the United States' point of view. They were helping in an intelligence coordination. Perhaps they were encouraging joint operations, but they didn't know that they were going to start assassinating people outside of Latin America. And I have evidence that shows that as soon as the United States found out that they were planning assassinations outside of Latin America, that they began, there was a big discussion inside the State Department about we should do something about this. We can't permit this.
My guest is journalist John Dinkus. His new book is called The Condor Years. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Dinkus. His new book is called The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to 3 Continents. Well, this leads us to the assassination of Orlando Letelier, who had been Salvador Allende's foreign and defense minister and had served as Allende's ambassador to Washington. He was assassinated in Washington, D.C., and also killed in the car was a 25-year-old woman named Ronnie Moffitt. Now, a question that has been circling this case ever since the assassination was, did the United States know about this? Was the United States in any way complicit in the assassination? You found a memo from Henry Kissinger that is a very important clue in this story. Would you describe what the memo is?
Well, we can't say that the United States was complicit in the assassination of Orlando Letelier. We can say that there was information that could have prevented the assassination had the United States acted on the intelligence that it had. Now, what happened was that the United States discovered the existence of Operation Condor and its plans to assassinate people like Letelier outside of Latin America. The specific intelligence was for Europe. But they also discovered that there was an actual mission heading to Washington. It had gone through Paraguay, and it was Chilean secret agents, and our intelligence discovered that mission. In addition, the CIA had discovered a plan to kill a U.S. congressman. All of this was happening in the 2 or 3 months right prior to the assassination. This intelligence was, in my analysis, of the level and quality that had it been acted on, it would have prevented the assassination from occurring. Now, what happened was that when this information was discovered by the CIA, it was reported to the State Department. The State Department officials, in an exchange of memos, I have more than 30 documents discussing this, recommended to Kissinger that he send instructions to his ambassadors to tell the heads of state of all of these countries involved in these plans that we know about them, we don't approve of them, this is going to be an enormous problem between these countries and the United States if these kinds of assassinations are carried out. And that memo went out to the ambassadors. Unfortunately, none of the ambassadors carried out the instructions. So at one point, the instructions were rescinded, and they were told to take no further action. In other words, the warnings telling the countries we know about these assassination plans were never delivered. In the case of Chile, the ambassador, David Popper, took it very seriously, actually asked for further instructions. He recommended that they go not to General Pinochet, the president, but to go to the head of the secret police. He thought that would be more effective. A month went by, and he received no further instruction. So the action that could have been taken on this intelligence was not actually taken, and as a result, the assassination went forward. There's a final cable that we have. It was the day before the assassination of Letelier, and in it, the head of the Latin American Bureau gives approval to rescind the order to the ambassadors and tells the ambassadors to take no further action.
There was a period of time between that initial memo to the ambassador say, you know, we're aware of this and you've got to tell the dictators in your country, in the country that you represent, that we're aware of this and it's got to stop. There was an interim of time that elapsed between that memo and the memo that went out saying, well, on second thought, don't take any action. How come no action was taken in between?
In that period, which is approximately a month, the documents that we have extensive sections blanked out. And there are certain documents that we know exist but have not been released. And the explanation, presumably, is in those still classified sections. I've interviewed all of the people who are alive and were participating in this, with the exception of Kissinger, who at this point was not dealing with the day-to-day negotiations on this. They don't have an explanation. One of the people who signed that final memo, Harry Schlotterman, said, I simply don't remember why we delayed in giving the further instructions to Chile. I think my interpretation, and I am loath to cast aspersions on State Department officials, but I have to conclude that they made a very bad intelligence error. The information was clear that something could have been done to have prevented the assassination that eventually occurred, and that what we're facing here is a cover-up of that intelligence error.
Why was Letelier targeted for assassination by Pinochet?
Letelier was one of the most important and attractive figures of the opposition. He was somebody that I think would have been a candidate for president once democracy was restored. But most importantly, Letelier was somebody who was very effective in organizing opposition against Pinochet. He had very good contacts in Washington. Henry Kissinger, in an interview, talks about having lunch several times with Letelier during this period prior to his assassination. Letelier was instrumental in passing some key legislation, human rights legislation, not, of course, passing it, but lobbying for it with his contacts with senators, for example, Senator Kennedy and other members of Congress. He traveled to Europe frequently and was involved in getting some loans and some business deals cut off from Chile only a few months before his assassination. He was one of the people who was doing the most damage to Pinochet's prestige and also to his ability to be successful as in bringing the economy forward.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Dinges, and he is a former reporter for National Public Radio and former managing editor of NPR News. He now teaches at the Columbia School of Journalism. His new book is called The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents. You got a small taste of what the terror tactics of the secret police in Chile were like when you were reporting in Chile. The police came to your home and rounded up you and the other people you were living with and brought you to one of the main and most notorious prisons there. Would you describe what happened the day they came to your home?
It was a Sunday morning. Three or four men came up to the house. I was living outside of Santiago in a half-acre plot of land with a very nice house. And they said their little boy had been hit by a car, and they wanted to investigate this. They identified themselves as police. I quickly learned that these were not police and that there had been no accident, no little boy had been hurt. That just got them into the house, and within a half an hour, I realized that we were under arrest, that we were not free to go. They began to show us pictures of people, four pictures of two men, two women, and ask us whether we knew these people. I had never seen these people before. It turned out later that these pictures were of the four top leaders of the revolutionary group known as MIR in Chile, that's who they were pursuing. They eventually threw us in the back of a pickup truck, put scotch tape over our eyes, and took us all to a prison camp called Villa Grimaldi. And I kept track of where we were going, the roads we were going to, so that I could identify where I was being taken. And I later was able to confirm that this is where I was, where we were held. We were interrogated. I was interrogated very briefly. They said by the time they got to me that this was a mistake. We realize you're an American citizen. You have to understand that we have to use these tactics to protect you from the Marxist terrorists who are loose in the street. And at that point, they took us back, left us off far away from the prison camp, but closer to our house. We were very terrorized by this, but I don't want to make myself out to be a victim. Clearly, it was a mistake. When they realized it was a mistake, they released us.
What went through your mind during that period when you were in custody?
I knew about disappearances. A friend of my wife and mine had disappeared only a couple months before. We didn't know that he was dead. It turns out that he actually was being held at that prison where I was taken. He ultimately disappeared. We knew in general, we didn't know the extent of this. I felt as this was happening to us that anything could happen here. They could realize that I don't have anything to do, that I'm a journalist, I'm protected because I'm an American, or they could do to me what they had done to the Chileans. They could do to me what they had done to two Americans who had been killed in 1973 after the coup. I was scared, no question. I was petrified, but I somehow had the presence of mind, I guess it's the reporter's training, to keep track of every corner that we turned and which hills we were going up and hills we were going down, because I felt I had to keep this story going. I had to report the story even while I was in the middle of it.
Was that helpful to getting through the story, you know, to emotionally surviving the story, and then was that helpful in actually reporting the story?
I never told the story all these years because it was a personal story, and I never wanted to focus attention on me. This is the first time in this book that I've ever told that story publicly. I think it did help me. It kept my presence of mind. I kind of locked into the reporter mode of I have to gather every conceivable fact possible in this experience, and I still have engraved in my memory most of the details, even though this happened more than two decades ago.
My guest is journalist John Dinges. His new book is called The Condor Years. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist John Dinges. His new book, The Condor Years, is about the secret alliance between six Latin American dictatorships of the 70s, which worked together to assassinate their enemies. Dinges covered one of those dictatorships, the Pinochet regime in Chile. When we left off, we were talking about the time Dinges and his future wife were detained and interrogated by Chile's secret police. Now, you reported the incidents of your arrest to the U.S. consulate. You met with the vice consul, John Hall. You told him what had happened, and he suggested, well, you could file a complaint, but then they'll probably just expel you from the country. You later learned that the vice consulate, John Hall, was actually an undercover CIA officer. What was your reaction when you found that out? And how did you find that out?
I found that out in the course of my investigation of the Letelier case. I developed quite a few very good sources, and of course it was a relevant question, who was CIA and who wasn't. And so I was able to pretty much identify all of the CIA agents working inside the embassy. And I learned that John Hall was working at the consulate undercover as a CIA agent. I guess I reacted kind of cynically, saying, you know, well, big surprise. His recommendation to me was basically, you know, don't rock the boat. He convinced me that I shouldn't do anything about that, meaning that he wouldn't have to do anything about it. He wouldn't have to take my case to the Chilean government. And that was the extent of it. I think he had that dual hat on. On the one hand, he was the consular officer dealing with an American citizen in trouble. On the other hand, he was a CIA officer making sure that relations with the secret police were going to go smoothly.
So, you know, looking back, what do you think of that decision to have a CIA agent also serve as vice consul?
Well, there's a more notorious case than that. Another vice consul, Jim Anderson, was the person in the consulate, CIA agent in the consulate, who handled the Charles Horman case. And Charles Horman was the American journalist who was killed in 1973, shortly after the coup in Chile.
This was the story that was dramatized in the film Missing.
Yes. Now, I don't know that Jim Anderson did anything untoward, but to later reveal that the person that the family is dealing with, that the person given to handle that case is somebody who is a CIA agent, I think it's flabbergasting that this is the way the United States was operating at that time, that they were using CIA agents who were complicit with the encouragement of the coup, that these same people would be handling the murder of an American citizen. None of these things have ever been accounted for. There's never been a trial. There's never really been any resolution of that case. But the facts are pretty clear, and I think that there were some Again, in that case, as in the Letelier case later, some astounding intelligence failures, astounding failures on the part of simply good judgment on the part of U.S. officials in handling these cases.
Is the main warning that you come away with from investigating Operation Condor is that we can't, it's a bad idea to make allies of dictators who are brutalizing their own people in the name of fighting what you consider to be the greater enemy, which in the case of the 70s and early 80s was communism.
And now is the war, is terrorism, the terrible terrorism that has been committed against the United States itself. Even stating it, as you just have, it is amazing that we even have to say this, that the United States should ally itself with people who are committing mass murder, and that somehow we even have to debate this, is pretty astounding. Obviously, that was a mistake. We were supposedly defending democratic values by allying ourselves with people who had destroyed democracy. We were defending people's over the civil rights that are so dear to us, the rights of freedom of expression in the United States. We were defending those by participating in regimes who had destroyed all freedom of expression in their own countries, and were systematically violating the rights, even the rights to personal safety of people in their countries. It is trying to establish American values by allowing those values to be destroyed in other countries. It's obvious that that's a mistake, and I hope that we don't keep making that mistake.
John Dinkins, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be on your show again.
John Dinkins is the author of the new book, The Condor Years. He teaches at the Columbia University School of Journalism. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com, from Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves, and by Nonesuch Records, featuring mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson's recording of Bach cantatas number 82 and 199. More information available at nonsuch.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The movie American Splendor is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Screenplay. Many critics think it was one of the best films of 2003. Now it's out on DVD. It's based on Harvey Pekar's underground comic book series about his life. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Pekar and his wife, Joyce Brabner. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.